You've got to worry about the fact that the physical layout of your zigzag antenna, your PVC zigzag, as opposed to these pieces of wire, one might be horizontally polarized and one might be vertically polarized. So you may have a funny comparison in that particular way, if you know what I mean. So let's find out what you used to find out the gain was low. Was it just reception signal rate, KC2MMY, K2LAW?
Okay, Dick, I was just trying to throw out some numbers. The actual closer length is like of the piece of wire antenna is 15 feet on each side, okay? And I can tune that with my VersaTuner MFJ, can tune that down to 1.3 to 1, okay? And in answer to your last question, the way I am telling the gain is, yes, on receive, I can see at least 2 points of an S-meter better on the, and you can hear it, too. If you put a station on and you tune the switch antennas, you can hear a big increase on the crummy, on the simple antenna, you know, by at least 2 or 3 S-meter units. I hope that answers the question.
The 15 feet on each side wire antenna, was that horizontally polarized? And your 5x8 PVC thing, was that also horizontally polarized? Over to you, Ray.
Okay, the simple dipole is a dipole in the horizontal plane, so yeah, that's horizontally polarized. The other thing is a zigzag on each side. It's overall, if you looked at it, it's two squares that are horizontally polarized, but if you look at the actual wire, it zigzags vertically up and down the length of, you know, 5 foot up and down with spacing in between of a foot. So it goes 5 foot up, a foot to the left, 5 foot down, a foot to the left, 5 foot up, a foot to the left. So that's how that zigzag is going on each side.
And I presume the wire is wrapped on the outside of this PVC square. What holds the wire from sliding on those 1 foot spacings, Ray? Go ahead.
It's just zip tied. It's just an elaborate frame made out of PVC, and the wire is just zigzagged around different elements, if you want to call them that, legs of it, and it's that's it. It's just a squished accordion-like piece of a dipole. You're just taking a dipole and you're just squishing it into an accordion design.
Sounds good. What are you using for a balancing device? Back to you on that one, Ray.
Hey, Dick, it sounds good, it looks good, but it doesn't work. I did the poor man's balancing you suggested. On the connector, I wrapped a few turns of wire and just tied them together. Plus, I believe that my antenna tuner inside the shack also has a built-in balance.
The balun in the shack, if you're feeding it with coax, it doesn't solve the problem. The whole reason why you put a balun device at the antenna is to make sure that the outside of the coax cable doesn't get hot. The zigzag antenna on the 5x8 squares of PVC, what gauge wire did you make that out of, Ray?
I believe that's 18 gauge wire.
Yeah, that is a little bit on the thin side, which is going to start building up some resistance. A higher Q antenna has higher current flowing in it. I think you would see some improvement if that was 14-gauge wire instead of 18-gauge wire. But as long as you've used low-loss materials, and the 14-gauge wire would certainly do that, as long as your loading coil is made out of reasonably low-loss materials, as long as you can run that thing with 100 watts into it, key down for a couple of minutes, turn it off, walk over there and touch everything, everything's cold to the touch, it's got to be radiating the signal. And if it can radiate the signal, it's got to receive it. The only thing left now is polarization. Huh. You've got a bit of a mystery there as to why your 15-foot on each side wire dipole works better, and I think you're saying 2S units better. That's a lot of difference. That's a mystery, Ray. Is there any way you can take a picture of that and mail it to us so we can get a clue as to what it looks like? Over to you, Ray.
Sure, Dick. I took pictures of the whole thing while I was building it, all different phases, but I can send you a general picture. That would be great if you looked at it for me. And, you know, like I said, it works, but, I mean, it's got a lot of wire in it. It's got a lot of wire, and it just has less gain than a short piece of wire, and that's just kind of depressing. And so that's my situation. So I'll send you a pic. I appreciate it. And the QIQ is standing by, so maybe you have a few words. KP2MMY with, I don't know, RIW, I think K2RIW, and the other fellow.
Query W2TTT.
Yeah, I think the only explanation we've got is the thinness of the wire, the 18 gauge. I think the high Q of being compact antenna and thin wire, I think you're getting a lot of loss. The next person who wanted to break in from earlier was Glenn, KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've worked on 80 meters a lot, still do, and I think he's getting hit with a very, very fundamental problem, the way he's describing the antenna. One of the key things with 80 meters is to have the radiation point of the antenna at somewhere around 70 feet off the ground. Antennas on 80 meters that are below 70 feet off the ground, the performance degrades real fast. The only antenna that I've ever seen that's like around the 35 to 40 foot point off the ground that's got reasonable performance, and reasonable performance means continental United States, is usually the full loop horizontally mounted. So if you've got a full wavelength loop at horizontal at 35 to 40 feet off the ground, that'll work reasonably. I think the reason why his 20 foot antenna that was a wire just strung into the tree and then coming back to the tuner was working, letting buzz drop, it was probably because somewhere inside his shack or somewhere attached to the antenna tuner is a grounding system. So really what was happening is that half of his antenna was, or maybe a tenth of his antenna, was the 20-foot length of wire. The other half of his antenna in reality was his tuner and his grounding system. And that's what the antenna tuner was actually loading. So that really doesn't sound like much of a surprise. I could actually mention that I've seen people who live up in mountains on 80 meters who would actually have done silly experiments like taking an antenna tuner, connecting one end to a ground pipe and the other side to a steel desk, transmit into that at a fairly decent altitude on a mountain, and were able to actually get that to work. So that's not so surprising with the 20-foot length of wire. The other antenna, it sounds to me like it's a very, very compact antenna at a low altitude, and it sounds like he's getting the performance that I would expect, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn, you made it sound like making it compact must lower the performance. And as long as it's made up...
No, I don't mean that, Dick. I don't mean that at all.
Okay, then what did you mean? Altitude, certainly, is a big factor. Is there another factor that you can see that's affecting his 5x8 PVC compacted antenna other than the 18-gauge wire? Over to you, Glenn.
Canceling current in near proximity.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I've taken extremely compact antennas, like something very similar to two 10-foot or 9-foot stainless steel rods, brought them together and matched them at a T-mounted pole, but I put the pole up at 70 feet. So my compact antenna was tuned to a 50-ohm coax that I could feed the coax down with a very, very good match, but the match and the antenna was up at 70 feet. If he were to take that contraption of his, get a good 50-ohm match right at that structure, then attach his coax or his balanced feed line from there and run it all the way down into a shack, but get it up at 70 feet, I bet you would perform just well. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good suggestion, Glenn. In the case of a hamstick or any of these helical wound antennas, because you're winding it on a round form, and it looks like a helix, and it's more compact, tip-to-tip distance is a hell of a lot smaller, everybody is somewhat comfortable with that. If I made the helix fairly large in diameter, a couple of feet in diameter, let me make the helix 5 feet in diameter. And now once the helix is wound, let me put the two flat boards on each side and start pressing in on it so the helix now becomes flattened so that it's got the 5 feet up and down but only a couple of inches left to right, if you know what I mean. At first you would say, hey, you're canceling the field. Not necessarily. It's just a crazy flat winding of a coil, not too different from a hamstick. So as long as you resonate that structure, as long as it can run ice cold on transmit, that means it's got efficiency on transmit. And by the law of reciprocity, it's got to receive well. So although it may look like it's got the zigzagging and canceling the current, I don't quite accept that. But let's wait and see what happens when Ray mails us that picture, and if he ever gets a chance to rewind it with 14-gauge wire, I think it's going to work better. We'll soon find out. There's more to the story, and we don't have the end of this one yet. But don't give up, Ray. I think you're onto something. John, I know you wanted to give a bit of a talk, and so we better go over to that right now. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the deck man.
W2OSR, new topic. And 2RDV, comments on the topic.
NV1P with comments.
And W2TTT had a question for a comment on this. Same antenna as well.
OSR, we're not going to be able to take you as far as the first hour's worth of questions are concerned. We've made this promise that we try to answer everybody's questions in the first hour. John, go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, first I'm going to cover my question for the early part of the TechNet, which is getting late. It has to deal with magnetics. Do you want to approach that?
Go for it, John.
KC2WGV. Dick, during the past week I had a conversation for quite a while with Wesley, and he has explained an experiment he's done, and I've had similar experience, but my results were different. He claims that if a bar magnet is cut in half in the center, well, it doesn't matter where, but in the center, that the center point will now push away from each other because it changes magnetic properties. I have never experienced that. Anytime I've broken a magnet or cut it in half, it'll pull itself together. The poles remain exactly the same alignment as far as the magnetic domain. Could you give him a little help on that? Myself also.
Okay, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of opinions, not necessarily traceable to the Bureau, but I'm going to tell you what those opinions are based on. If I took a piece of material, a ferromagnetic material, that is capable of being magnetized and has coercivity to it, in other words, once I magnetize it, it tends to stay magnetized. If I got that kind of material, and if I'm looking at it microscopically and reading all the good books, what's happening? There's a whole bunch of individual microscopic domains, call them little chunks of steel, so to speak, grains of steel, that when you magnetize them, they previously had magnetic capability, but each of those little sections were random in their polarization. Some of them were north-south, some of them were up and down, some of them were left and right, some of them were at 45-degree angles in three-dimensional space. Those individual domains were scattered all over the place in orientation, spatial orientation. I put it across this great big electrifying magnet where I now magnetize my chunk of steel. What I've done is I've forced all of those individual domains to all lie parallel to each other. So I'm making them all have north on the left side and south on the right side on this horizontal bar magnet on the table in front of me. And coercivity really means that once you've oriented those individual domains, they tend to stick there. They've got resistance. That's how a permanent magnet stays permanent. They tend to stick in that particular orientation. Let me drop. So now I've got practical purposes, I've got this bar magnet with all of those individual domains all lined up in a parallel manner, all north on the left side, all right, south on the right side. If I suddenly cut that magnet in the middle with my Dremel tool, I didn't take all of those individual domains and with, even though they've got resistance, they've got stiction, they want to stay there, I didn't reverse any of them. They're all north on the left side and all south on the right-hand side after I did the cut. As such, the individual magnets are going to keep their individual domains of magnetization. Therefore, no reversal takes place just because I created a cut. Because I created the cut, and I've now increased the total magnetic reluctance of that path, with assume now that I've got lines of force flowing out of the north side of the original magnet, flowing around in space and coming back into the right-hand side, the south side. And now when I break it into two particular smaller pieces, I've now got a different reluctant path of each of those pieces. But to say that they're going to suddenly reverse, that somebody is coming along and moving those domains, I doubt it. I still think that after you've broken the two different pieces, each piece separately is north on the left, south on the right. Therefore, where you did the cut, they're going to be attracting each other from that point on. That's what I think is going to happen. I'm reasonably sure with the discussions John and I have had, that's what John also thinks is going to happen. Before I toss it back to Wesley, anyone else listening to me, we're going to turn to Wesley in a minute, but before we do, does anybody else differ with what I just said? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RAW in the TechNet. I've
got a better example for you, K2.
Can I have a comment?
Eric and Glenn recognized. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, let's look at a different piece of medium. I mean, how does magnetic tape work? Or even size, for that matter. You take little pieces of iron, and they're just scattered in any direction. Now, the binder on the tape is a glue that holds the particles to the tape. And what they do when they make magnetic tape is they pass it through a magnetic field, which, while the tape is still fluid, still liquid, all the little particles line up the north, say, facing to the left, and the south facing to the right. And then the glue sets, and all those little particles of magnetic material remain oriented that way. Although the pieces of material that you put on a magnetic tape are not actually magnets, they're pieces of iron. But it's the same sort of idea in a permanent magnet or even a piece of ferrite.
Yeah, let me add to what you just said. Once I've recorded my favorite piece of music on that particular magnetic tape, and now I come along with my scissors and cut it periodically because I want to do editing. Although I may be cutting out pieces of the original recording in the time domain, I don't think any reversal of polarity takes place at the places where I cut it with scissors. What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
I agree with you 100%. That's how they actually get to edit audio tape.
Okay. Glenn, KC2QIQ, give us your words on this, K2RIW. You should wait for the beep, even though we didn't, Glenn.
Actually, Dick, that was John, but I'm KC2QIQ.
Okay, I confused you. I knew it was an authoritative voice. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. And don't forget, Dick, when you cut the bar magnet in half, for that to happen, only one half has to change domains. So that's why I think it's kind of insane.
Well, at first, if I may say something, at first, when you pick two magnets, both act as magnets, then both have the north and south poles. Each in both the pieces corresponding north and south poles remain on the sides, as in the original magnets. This means that two broken sides must get oppositely polarized. But the experiments that I have provided shown that immediately after the breaking, two pieces run in opposite direction. So it's, it, there is, they get similarly polarized. north to north and south to south on each broken side. So that was why I asked, how is it possible? And I think maybe Glenn knows the answer of that. Andrexia.
Now, there's also something called the degaussing phenomenon. If you've got a very specifically magnetized thing, like, say, for instance, a set of magnets that are on a traveling wave tube or the set of magnets that are on a circulator or isolator, you're being told not to bring metallic objects, magnetic metallic objects nearby, or not to physically shock it or not to physically put it at a high temperature. You can change the degree of magnetization by raising the temperature of the magnet, by bringing other objects nearby. It's only a partial degaussing, but you can. And in some cases, a very strong physical shock will change magnetization to some degree. So if you had this bar magnet and you decided to break it with a sledgehammer, and then you made a judgment that the magnetic field in the individual pieces changed in a certain way, that's a pretty violent act. If you did it with a Dremel tool, without the things getting real hot, I don't think you're going to get reversal. I think of the two pieces that you get after the cut, I think the left-hand side of each will be north, and the right-hand side of each will be south, and therefore, where you did the cut, they're going to tend to attract each other.
Well, Dick, if you go to the internet, because I was doing that hundreds of times during my life, every time it was repelling itself, you're going to find that. So it's not a fact only of my imagination. I wonder what Glenn has to say about it. But my belief is that strength won't reduce in either piece, because they still have one pole each of the original magnet, so the other end will have an infinite opposite polarity, so flux should not change either, but for some reason it is. I remember that there was the occlusion in BDS equals zero, but I'm not going to take a stand on it. Glenn, maybe you could say something.
Wes, in order for them to now reverse polarity and repel each other after the break, the left side piece or the right side piece, one of them would have to reverse. If both of them reversed, you would still be attracting. If only one is going to reverse in order to get the repulsion effect after the break that you're describing, how does one decide which one's going to reverse and the other one decide it's not to? Where does that intelligence come from? N2XJN, K2RAW.
Well, I've seen that all the time. I have never seen the magnets that pull each other. Well, they were always repelling each other. John has seen different. And I'm asking Glenn, well, how is that happening? Keep typing in Google, why magnet changes polarity when broken. There are probably 2,000 of information about it. How then, if this is my pure imagination, or maybe, delusional thinking, that is present on Google? Simple answer, Glenn. How is it happening?
Moon is made of green
tea. KC2QIQ. If you got an opinion on this, go right ahead, Glenn. K2RAW.
Well, basically what happens here is that we have iron. Iron's the base material for magnet-type materials. And without iron, most of these magnetic properties don't exist. So iron is kind of the base material. Now, when iron is mixed with dielectric materials, as Eric had mentioned, plastics, glues, epoxies, the formulated iron tends to hold one position. When you mix your iron with other metals, strange properties can happen because of atomic count mixtures. So it's not unlikely that can happen, but it's not likely either. but it can happen with mixed metal binders. It is certainly a possibility, but I wouldn't say it's all that common. I would say the most common type of magnet that most people have seen is what they call the powdered iron composite magnet, which is usually used with a epoxy type binder. But I would imagine that there are other metal bound iron magnets that could actually have this property, especially if they're cut off of center. In other words, they're not at 50% of the bulk. It's something off of the 50% point, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I believe I have something in addition to it. When I was playing with it, and it was in Europe, we didn't have the synthetic magnet. Didn't have something. It was a powder and was formed and then magnetized. We have had a magnet that were made from the steel of very high hardness. So when you take the tensile and you measure, it was extremely hot. Now you've seen that magnet when you drop it peel. You've seen like a small pieces, usually flat and sometimes very, very sharp, get out of it. Maybe that helps, Glenn.
Okay, Glenn, you're saying that with certain kinds of compositions of ferrite magnets, you see the possibility of the cut area repelling as opposed to attracting.
Is that a correction, Dick? Iron metals versus iron dielectrics.
No matter what the material is, if after the cut it's going to repel, that can only happen if the left side after the cut or the right side after the cut decided to reverse. Only one would have to reverse to get repulsion. If both reversed, it'd get attraction again. So if only one side is going to reverse, how does much of nature decide which half is going to reverse and the other half is not going to? How does Mother Nature make that decision? Over to you, Glenn.
It's actually a relatively random process, Dick. It's mainly due to shock. There has to be a mechanical shock. In other words, typically, I think if you use a saw to cut it, it would be very unlikely that you would see it. But in other words, if you were to break it or snap it, typically, if you have metal oxides with iron, and it's dropped, and it's a fragile material, it cracks, and you try to push the two pieces back together again, it's a very good chance, Dick, after that mechanical shock, they're not going to go back together again, they're going to repel. But if you were to take the powdered iron type materials that were magnetized in a plastic binder, you would snap it, it'll always snap back together in the same position, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Interesting. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm listening to this. There's a couple of observations I'd like to make. The process of cutting anything is generally, you can think of that as friction, which is going to generate heat. But, you know, if we were talking about something at the molecular level, where that we had, say, a row of iron, you know, two rows of iron at it, and then we shock it or we give it a little heat, which is going to try and change the polarization of those pieces of iron. But from what I'm hearing, it's like we take a bar magnet. Now, let's say a bar magnet's an inch long, and you make a cut that's, you know, 64th of an inch wide. So, yeah, you generate a little heat at that point of cut. You still have the rest of all that material, which is pretty much undisturbed. So even if you rock a couple of those atoms around at the point of the cut, you still have all the force of the rest of the bar, you know, exerting its field. And what it would do is force the other side to either become neutral and have no magnetism, as we think of in the outset, or, you know, the strength of the amount of Gauss of the remaining material would kind of force the material that got shifted to line back up with it. I mean, I just don't see it, even in composite magnets. Now, most people forget that most magnets that are made are not magnetic. When they start, they have to be magnetized. We're not talking about a piece of lodestone here that was, you know, comes out of here that was part of lava. When the lava finally cooled off, its orientation is, you know, fixed. So I see a couple of problems with this.
KC2QIQ with a comment and an answer.
No, that phenomena in here, I'm going to read it, a short one.
Okay, yeah. With reference to the cutting creating extra heat, and every magnet has got something called the Curie temperature, you exceed that temperature and magnetization essentially disappears. While I'm doing the cutting, if I'm smart enough to do it with an oil bath, a water bath, or whatever, I could be doing cooling at the same time I'm doing the cutting. If I did that, now I'm not raising the temperature per se in the area where I'm doing the cutting. Therefore, do you believe I can now do the cut without any reversal taking place? Eric first on that one. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, again, at a molecular level, you know, unless you're dipping it in liquid nitrogen when you're cutting it, I still see a little heat. Not only heat, but vibration, mechanical shock is occurring, even if it's at a small amount. But, you know, what are we talking about here? We still have a mass of material that remains, you know, gradient temperature-wise down the line, and unless you've shocked the entire thing at the point of cut, then, you know, there's a little vibration going on. I still don't see it.
Dick Query, W2TTG.
What have you heard on this one, Gordon? W2TTG, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ, still with one more comment.
Yeah, I'll be real quick. My only question is, could you have a lack of reversal and create essentially an asymmetric, you know, bar magnet from one or both pieces as a result of cutting or breaking those? Could you create what I'll call a magnetically chaotic border zone that would, you know, create an asymmetry in the field? So the let's say the uncut end is the north, and whether it shifts or not, would the south end then be, or the newly created south end, be weaker in its strength? And I'm just kind of curious about that because of the heating action. QIQ, go.
I have an answer for the day found.
Glenn first, KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
The key to this is mechanical shock. I'll give an example of a magnet that if you were going to do aviation and you were going to make aviation instrumentation that required a magnet, a magnet you're not going to use is going to be a cobalt. And why? Why would you ask me? Why wouldn't I use cobalt if I'm going to do aviation, especially if you're going to use something that requires something that's going to have a rigid polarized magnet that's not going to change? And the reason is because of shock and impact. If you take a cobalt magnet and bring it over to, let's say, one of our nice local testing labs like Dayton T. Brown, they have a nice little drop table over there where you can put a piece of lead underneath the bottom and you can raise your cobalt magnet and drop it down and, I don't know, give it about 10 G's of shock and watch the ring wave that goes through it. Then measure that magnet afterwards, Dick. Sometimes it's interesting. Depending on the shock wave that it's hit with, it can not only reverse, it can reverse once and twice and come back to the original again. So sometimes I've seen it where when they do this kind of testing on certain magnets, and that's one of the reasons why cobalt's been ruled out for high vibration shock type of atmospheres, because of that metal mixture and shock. It's been known and proven to reverse. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
When you say cobalt, does that include Alnico? Back to you, Glenn.
I'm pretty sure the Alnico is not as severe, mainly because it's a softer, it's a softer type, but the Alnico tends to lose its magnetism with time, but the cobalt, other one, seems to hold a little bit stronger over time. But they both will eventually have that kind of problem, so where if they're dropped into a shock, yeah, they can reverse, and it's random, and it's a problem. And I know it has to be tested, and generally, for things like aviation and other areas, they're typically the plastic binder iron magnets that have to be used because of that specific problem. But here again, as you said in Wesley's case, where if he snapped one, in other words, like you drop it and it cracks, and it's one of those metal mix types, can it reverse? Yeah, it could. Is it likely? You know, who knows? It's, you know, you probably have to hit it with somewhere in the area of like 10 G's to do it, but it can happen. And it does.
You said cobalt, and you didn't say iron. Is there a kind of magnet that is pure cobalt, and it's a steady-state permanent magnet? Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, let's take a step back. All magnetic property is iron. Iron, Dick. No iron, no magnetism. So everything, all your magnets are iron. Now, you have a choice. How do you hold your iron together? Iron is not a very rigid, well, it's rigid, but it can be very delicate. It can come in powder. It's fragile. It will crack. So you have to, when you're going to try to hold iron together, it's typically mixed with a binder. In other words, the binder holds it, so you're making a strong, producible magnet, something that you can manufacture. So you've got a couple of different ways of going about this. You can use your plastic binders to hold them together, or you can use metal binders. Cobalt is one of the metal binders.
So therefore, there is a compound or a mixture of iron particles and cobalt particles?
Right on.
So after you mix them, you melt them into a solid mass and then magnetize it, or do you magnetize it while it's cooling?
Take your pick. It depends on the magnet manufacturer and what their processes are. As a matter of fact, one thing that you'll find out when you're dealing with magnetics companies that build magnets, ferrite cores, iron cores for transformers, everybody's got their own recipe. And the way people make magnets and magnetic materials, there's a lot of common ones out there that follow like certain properties. But I think what you'll also find out is that when you find out how each manufacturer runs their processes, they keep them all very, very close. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Quick comment, Dick.
Dick, I sent you the email with the question asked in Israel in the school, in the university, and the answer from the Department of Physics. So you have everything right now in your mail.
Okay, John and Wesley recognized. Glenn, if cobalt is not recommended to be used on an aircraft application, what do you use instead?
A plastic binder on your iron. So in other words, there are all types of magnets that can be used. But when I said aviation, meaning the reason there is that shock, if you have a magnet that, if it reversed its polarity, it could be detrimental to the flight operation of that plane, that's not the kind of magnet you want to use. You want to use a plastic binder magnet.
Okay. Now, maybe I've experienced this. I own a compass that when I use the compass, the south end of the compass will aim north. Either they put the magnet in there backwards and at the point of manufacture, or I dropped it or did something nasty to it, and it's a backwards compass. Any guesses? Have you ever heard of that happening? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's kind of common. That, in other words, this was something that was learned the earlier years in aviation, I think before World War II even, that a metal mixture iron magnets were not really good for aviation and navigation, that you had to use the plastic binders. And if it's one of the low-cost or, you know, type of compasses where it's got the metal arm and it's got the iron mix on the outside of the metal, chances are just a good shock or a good hit could reverse it. And that's why you can't do that. Sometimes, Dick, if you probably take that and very, very carefully give it a good knock or a good jab with a, you know, with a little hammer without breaking the glass or anything else on the compass, but hit it in a good spot where you can shake it again, 9 out of 10 times you can reverse it one more time and bring it back. But be careful, because if you hit it the wrong way, you'll reverse it once, and then you'll reverse it twice, and it'll be back to where you started again. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, Glenn, could you tell me why Mother Nature says to one half to reverse the polarity and not to the other? What that depends from?
Do you want me to explain the principle of why shock reverses the polarity of the magnet?
Nope. Why you have a two halves? What makes this particular half to change the polarity, not the other?
The inside of the metal magnet that is, that one of the things about shock, it's a very, very interesting thing to study, that shock typically travels in a wave, and you usually have one end of the crack in a shock that usually is called a receptor. So shock is not shared equally on both sides, and usually the end that absorbs the energy is the side that gets reversed, Wesley.
Okay, we're hearing a possibility that it could happen. John and Eric in that order. John, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Don't forget, Dick, Wesley has experienced that in all of the events. Glenn is sort of saying it's not something that's, it's like a 50-50. Wesley's 100% on the other side. Something's wrong. Back to you, Dick.
I think I can accept. It sounds ridiculous. What? If you look, Dick, at your email right now, the last email that I sent a few minutes ago, there is a from School of Israel, and they say exactly the same. So maybe there is somehow related to geographic location. I know it's insane, that it's insane, but I have never, ever seen. And I broke it as a child plenty of times for fun and to exist.
Okay, you've experienced it. Eric, KE2EJ, where do you stand on all this?
I just decided to look up ferromagnetic materials and look at their properties. And the various different combinations of materials and their various different purity temperatures. But I've come across something very interesting here, and it has to do with quantum mechanics and the orbital angular momentum of the electrons traveling about the nucleus and how the magnetic dipoles are aligned in the same direction, and how there's something called exchange interaction, how things can actually flip, and it really has to do with the rotation of the molecules as they're oriented against each other. And I'm finding what Glenn is saying is basically right, and there are different combinations of material that they're carried. But another interesting property that I just ran across is that lithium gas, cooled down to about 1 degree Kelvin, also exhibits magnetism, which is pretty interesting in itself. So, you know, that part of the periodic chart which aligns themselves to being acceptable material to create magnetism, you know, along with iron. But we're talking about these materials in combination with iron, so that's just interesting. The more I dig into it, the more interesting it becomes. K2RIWK2J.
Let me ask a very basic question of all of the brain power that's present here right now. What is magnetism? Is it the orientation of the orbits of the electrons around the nucleus? If they all have the same axis, does that make magnetism? Is it the spin of the electrons? Does that make magnetism? Is it something to do with the nucleus of the atom and the way it spins and the way the protons or neutrons spin? I mean, is 90% of the magnetic field created by the orbit of the electrons? Orbit of the electrons, and some of the percentage or something else? Who feels that they know where the magnetism is really coming from? Give me a call that is right now, K2RIW.
It can be all those things, W2CTT. I'll give you the answer to Dick, but you're not going to like it.
Okay. Gordon thinks it's all. Glenn's got an opinion. Just before we start giving the answer, is there anyone else who wants to go on the list because they know what magnetism is coming, where it's coming from?
Intuition.
I can give you what Wikipedia says.
Okay. Glenn first, KC2QIQ, go right ahead. Where is the magnetism coming from? And if it's more than one source, what percentage is each with the average magnetic material? You got it, Glenn.
Well, magnetism is a force, just like electricity, you know, that's what, but it's actually combined. When you're looking at the electrostatics and electromagnetics, they're both together, they're a very, very closely associated force, but they're separate forces. You have the electromagnetic force, you know, and it's basically broken up to one half of it that we can analyze as magnetism, and the other half of it that we're looking at is the electrical and the current side. So we have volts amps on one end of the electromagnetic force, and on the other side we have the Gauss-Oersted's side. So we have four dimensions that we're dealing with. We have E, I, B, which is flux intensity, and H for Oersted's. So we basically have these units, and we're measuring these forces of energy. Now, what is the source of forces of energy? You know, here again, that's like asking, what is love? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but I'm really asking, at the molecular level of a magnetizable material, where is it coming from?
This would be nice.
Let me read you something.
Go ahead, Eric.
This is just a direct quote from Wikipedia. The Bohr van Leeuwen's theorem shows that magnetism cannot occur in purely classical solids. Without quantum mechanics, there would be no diamagnetism, paramagnetism, or ferromagnetism. The property of ferromagnetism is due to the direct influence of two effects from quantum mechanics, spin and the Pauli exclusion principle. And if you want me to go on, then they have the origin of magnetism and how they explain that it works.
Yeah, but the Pauli exclusion principle would lead you to believe that no two electrons in the first orbit can have the same direction. They've got to be opposite in direction. If they're opposite in direction, as a magnetic field creator, that would sound like it's canceling. So there's something else going on here. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, they go on to say that one of the fundamental properties of an electron, besides that it carries a charge, is that it has a dipole moment. In other words, it behaves itself as a tiny magnet. The dipole moment comes from a more fundamental property of the electron, that it has a quantum mechanical spin. The quantum mechanical nature of this spin causes the electron to be able to be in two states, with the magnetic field either pointing up or down, or any choice of up or down. The spin of the electron and atom is the main source of ferromagnetism, although there is also a contribution from the orbital angular momentum of the electron and its spin about the nucleus. When these tiny magnetic dipoles are aligned in the same direction, the individual magnetic fields add together and create a measurable macroscopic field. Let me let it drop for a second. However, in materials with a filled electron shell, the total dipole moment of the electrons is zero because the spins are in up-down pairs. Only atoms with partially filled shells, in other words, unpaired spins, can have a net magnetic moment. So ferromagnetism only occurs in materials with partially filled shells. Because of Hund's rule, the first few electrons in the shell tend to have the same spin, thereby increasing the total dipole movement. These unpaired dipoles are often simply called spins, although they generally include angular momentum, tend to align in parallel to an external magnetic field, an effect called paramagnetism. Paramagnetism involves an additional phenomena, however. The dipoles tend to align spontaneously, giving rise to a spontaneous magnetization even when there's no field applied. Go with that.
With that last sentence, can I take Glenn's example of taking a material that is capable of being magnetized, but right now it's not, and if I shock it just the right way, do I get a magnet? What do you think, Eric?
Well, from what I'm reading, I think that's possible. What do you think, Glenn?
Kinetic sense.
Here again, guys, you're not going to like my answer, but the answer is no. I'll let it pause for a minute, and then you can tell me if you want me to explain why.
Let us know what your magnetic experience has told you, Glenn.
Iron materials and materials with iron fall into that compound area where we have materials that can be magnetized and hold their magnetism without having an electrical current present upon the material after magnetic field's been applied. if the binder used is metal, what's actually happening there is that what's actually causing the reversal in some cases is when it's shocked, what's actually happening is the iron part of the iron part of the domain and the metal part of the domain actually migrate and shift in that shock. So what's actually happening is because these are microscopic fields that's taking place, a shock wave moves through the material and shifts the domain so that basically the currents are still flowing in the same direction, but because they shifted over one, the overall magnetism of the total sum material is now reversed to north-south to south-north. That's actually what's happening. But if you have a material that is not charged and you drop it, you can shake the metal against the iron, you know, the submetal against the iron, and there's no field shift because the currents weren't initially initiated. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
My goodness, there's a fair amount of mystery with magnets. We've all seen those magnetic lines of force demonstrated to us by putting iron filings on a piece of paper that's held over a magnet. So we know that there are lines of force there. We don't know what they are, and we're having a little trouble figuring out exactly where they come from. And it looks like a lot of funky stuff is going on here. Go ahead, Wes. See if you can straighten this all out. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Can I have one more comment first, though, Dick?
Go ahead, Glenn.
When we look at magnetism at the atomic level, in other words, getting away from the ferrite iron properties that we know that create the large-scale magnetic fields that we're all used to measuring, it follows the same basic rules that you have to have electrical charge, and that's when, you know, when Eric is talking about having, you know, unfilled, you know, shells that basically have dissimilar charge. So once you have dissimilar charge, once there's charge, now you can have magnetism. So you see, the funny thing about EM, electromagnetics as a spectrum, is that the two fields work together simultaneously, so that when you're basically stacking a charge, you also have a field. So in other words, a magnetic field. The two are related at the molecular level. Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Is there latency between the creation of each of the, and destruction of each of the two?
Glenn, you used the word charge three times. I'm a little bit confused by that. Every normal atom has an equal number of electrons and an equal number of protons. Therefore, under normal circumstances, every atom is electrically neutral, and yet you're talking about these charges. If you're talking about the spins being unequal, because half of them are positive, half of them are negative, if it's a filled orbit, but if it's a partially filled orbit, parallelism of spin, and parallelism is not the right word, an even number of spins, half of them odd, half of them even, half of them clockwise, half of them counterclockwise. So spin differences I'll accept, but you use charge difference multiple times, and I thought a usual atom that's not a non-ionized atom, to me is neutral. So maybe there's a vocabulary problem here. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
No, Dick, I think you're getting it right on. What's happening here is that when you have atoms that are balanced, there's no charge. When there's no charge, there's no magnetic field. Isn't that cool? So you need the dipole. In other words, you need charge, the charge imbalance within the molecule. Now, once you've got a molecule that has the imbalance inside of it, and now you've got a share property between two atoms at that point in time, now you can determine charge. And to actually confuse you even a little bit more, in the basic elements of things like hydrogen, you actually, in order to create true defined charge, you need three atoms together in order to get the correct balance. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Can I take a sample?
According to chemistry.
If my magnetic material was a compound, life gets complicated. Is it possible to make a magnet out of nothing but iron atoms? And if each individual iron atom is not ionized, In other words, it's got the same number of electrons as protons of each individual iron atom. I say that is neutral. Where's the word charge coming in here, Eric? I mean, Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
If the molecules are balanced such that the total sum of that material is neutral, then there is no charge and there is no magnetism. So, but can you take that material and arrange it so that you put a coil of wire around the outside of your block of iron, and now you put a coil around the outside and basically now magnetize it so that you create a domain of magnetic fields within it? Yes, then all of a sudden you have charge and magnetism.
Glenn, you made some kind of a change on that last transmission. Your audio is 15 decibels lower. What change did you make, Glenn?
How's the audio now, Dick? Is it working?
Negatory. Your audio is 15 decibels low. What change did you just make?
No change. Have to check it out.
Try wiggling your cable and hit the microphone once or twice.
I don't know. I think I might have a problem here. Did the audio come back?
The audio came back. A little bit of scratchiness, but the audio came back. So there's a little bit of something funny going on with the mic. So can I take pure iron atoms and make a magnet out of those? And aren't the individual iron atoms electronically neutral? Same number of electrons versus the number of protons in each individual atom. Back to you, Glenn.
I don't think it can't be perfectly pure iron. I think you have to have something in between. In other words, you have to have some spacing and some other material in between.
The audio jumped down very low again, but we did hear you. Alrighty. I think pure iron makes a non-permanent magnet. In other words, very little coercivity is there. It gives me a beautiful low reluctance as a material in an electromagnet, but I think it has very little properties as a permanent bar magnet, so to speak. So I've got to make compounds. And now once I make a compound, I guess you're saying that within the compound of iron plus something else, nickel, cobalt, samarium, and all these other materials that they put in there, neodymium. Once I make these compounds, now there is a polarization to the individual molecule, not atom, but molecule. And so I think you're saying the molecular polarization is each individual molecule with its polarization, is that the domain that is being aligned when I magnetize that material? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
I would say that's accurate, Dick. That's the way I'm explaining it. I hope my audio came back.
Yes, it did. A little bit noisy, but lots of audio came back. Okay. We're slowly getting a little bit of a handle on magnetism. My goodness, is it complicated. The number of terms that are used for describing magnetic properties is awfully high. The mixtures and the translations between them is not easy. Gilberts and Oersteds and Teslers and always in lines of force and killer lines and Gauss. It just goes on and on. I know there's a relationship between all of these. N2XJN, go ahead, Wes. K2RIW.
Yeah, as always, I have a little bit different approach as I'm trying to research for something that is just a little variation from the main street knowledge or science. Let me jump. But yeah, everybody has two magnets together and both of them attract and repel each other, but on the atomic scale, the definition of the magnet becomes a little bit different. I would say that the substance containing atoms that exert a magnetic force of other atoms is considered to be a magnet. The biggest difference between those two situations is that one, that on the microscopic scale, a magnet is made up of atoms whose magnetic moments all work in the same direction, acting together. And on the atomic scale, however, the magnet can be composed of atoms whose moments point in many different directions, working together or potentially canceling each other. There is a scientist called George Ehler, and he was trying to fight magnetism as the phenomena in the spin ice. And there's a group of scientists that he is leading, basically, he says that the structure that has the relationship and the property very much, I'm trying to get to the particle part on it, crystals, okay. The term speed ice is applied to the material whose magnetic structure is comparable to the crystal structure of the water ice. As one might expect, water ice has been studied in depth, so the similarities between the two materials provide researchers with a model of sort for their investigation. I'm reading right now. The spin ice of Ehler and his colleagues is basically H2TI207, where the holmium has been replaced with non-magnetic lanthanum. The reason for doing that might be a little bit more obvious, but they brought the description of the retarded or frustrated magnet, which actually is that what is the frustrated magnet? In solid materials, individual magnetic moments can point in a number of different ways. Usually that is an arrangement that requires the last energy to maintain. And this arrangement of magnetic moments you would most often find. But then when you're dealing with something that is being called spin ice, then the spin ice is a type of frustrated magnet. Similar to water magnetic moments in spin ice can assume any of several different tetrahedral configuration, all with the same ground state energy. But when the ice freezes, the possible variant configuration prevent it from easily finding its last energy configuration or long range order. So that basically they say stands for the fundament of the magnetization or magnetism by itself. Basically they take a certain chemical impurities and add it to the water, and they eliminate the frustration and make long-range order in ice crystals. At that point, they say that they could do it the same with the metal, trying to actually simulate the phenomena that came that's happening in the ice water.
Okay, I think you're saying now that the crystallization of water molecules when ice is formed has a kind of matrix, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a memory. It got to this state, cannot repeat to the other. It cannot recall what was before till it stay in the state.
So magnetized domains in a solid material that has been magnetized, I think you're saying, has some of those properties. Maybe that helps a little bit.
What are you saying here? I've got it. In the project of Ehler's team, and there is probably 20 different names, of a Russian, Japanese, and whoever, says that they were trying to determine what happens on the atomic scale when the spin ice freezes, in particular how the impurities in the spin ice, like the added lanthanum, change the freezing process, and comparing that to the magnet.
Alrighty, I know that what we're doing right now is carrying out John's request to discuss reversal. Is it real or not reversal when you break a bar magnet into two pieces? Do we also have, John, any of the mailed-in material that we should cover tonight? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2, Oscar Lombardo with a quick comment and a good read for you guys for E&M.
You said KC2 blank, blank, blank. You said it so fast I didn't get it. With a quick comment. Give me your full call and your name and go ahead with your comment.
It's Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Lima Bravo. The name is Alan. And if you guys want to know more, I highly recommend David Griffith's Electricity and Magnetism. It's a really good read and covers all the topics that you just discussed in mathematical depth and theory.
And Alan, after you read Griffith's, did you get a warm, fuzzy feeling as to what really creates a magnetic field? Is it the orbit of the electron, the spin of the electron, or something that's going on in the nucleus, or all of the above? Which do you feel it is, Alan? Go ahead.
Well, to me, I believe it's mostly dependent on the spin, the net spin of each atom making up the magnetic material. And, I mean, it was explained, you know, after I took quantum physics, you know, that's what I, my alignment is towards that.
Alan, you said spin of the atom. Are you telling me the individual complete atoms